We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, as usual, starting with local and Mayor Mike McGinn.
Yeah, this week Mayor McGinn released his jobs proposal. He presented it to a city council committee. He tried to kind of sneak this by the city council, I think. He had convened a roundtable of advisors, not a public roundtable group that that solicited public opinion, but more just a group of his buddies in the developer community to sit down and kind of figure out what they wanted from the city. And they came up with a proposal, which, of course, he billed as his jobs proposal. And it's really a pro-developer's agenda. It would eliminate a layer of environmental review for new buildings up to 75,000 square feet or with fewer than 200 apartments. It would also allow more businesses in residential areas where single-family homes primarily are. And it would get rid of parking spaces for housing built near transit lines or bus lines. The city council committee rejected the part of the proposal that would put more businesses in low-rise residential neighborhoods, but they're still looking at some of the other pieces of this jobs proposal. And I have to say, I think the most disturbing part of it is eliminating the layer of environmental review, which also means eliminating neighborhood feedback for buildings up to 75,000 square feet. Now, if you think about that, 75,000 square feet is not small. If you had, say, 150 apartments of 500 square feet, you know, a building under 200, or, you know, 75,000 square feet or a building with less than 200 units in it, if you had 150 apartments with about 500 square feet in there, that's about 75,000 feet. So that tells you about what size building you're talking about. You're talking about development that can take up a whole city block that could be, you know, 10 stories with 20 units on a floor. That's a big building.
I would add to that also the elimination of the parking requirements is also a fairly serious problem, because we've seen what has happened to a lot of neighborhood business districts and areas where they've imposed pay parking over the last several years, mm-hmm. where it's really hurt the small independent businesses and neighborhood districts.
Yeah, and you know, environmental review is not just about owners of single family homes sitting down with the city and saying, look, we don't want this big apartment building in our neighborhood, or we don't want this big block store near us. What it's really about, it's about a lot of different things, including building heights in a neighborhood. It's about
traffic flow,
green space and parks in a neighborhood. It's about views. It's about traffic density, as Jav said, in neighborhoods. It's also about things like the capacity of a local school to handle an influx of residents in an area. It's also about fire stations. It's about a lot of things. And eliminating environmental review for buildings that could take up a whole city block, that could be anywhere from 10 stories to 20 stories high, that I think that's very much a gift to developers. And it could have it could do more than just encourage a little bit more density in the city of Seattle.
And again, as we've made this point in this show before, that for the 20-year neighborhood plan and city plan of the amount of density and the amount of population growth that Seattle is supposed to incur between now and, I believe, it's 2020. Seattle is already way over those goals. We do not need more incentives for developers. We've been doing nothing politically but incentives for developers all the way through the Nichols administration and now into the McGinn administration, while doing almost nothing to, for example, retain affordable housing in the city of Seattle. It really seemed like a misplaced set of priorities, and a misplaced set of priorities that's very much being driven by the economics rather than by the public good.
Yeah, and ostensibly the excuse for doing this is, you know, we want to make neighborhoods more walkable, and we want to increase density for environmental reasons, and we want to create great neighborhoods where people want to move into the city and have stores nearby, et cetera. But, you know, you don't create great walkable neighborhoods by allowing enormous buildings to be built without any kind of environmental review. What makes great walkable neighborhoods are small, you know, or big box stores of 75,000 feet. Now, what makes great walkable neighborhoods are smaller apartment buildings with smaller stores on thoroughfares, usually located on thoroughfares, with a lot of residences, including single-family dwellings on the side streets or nearby streets. Those make great walkable neighborhoods with great views, with good nearby parks, et cetera. But that's not what this agenda is all about.
And if you're going to do the really large buildings and businesses that are destination points for outside the neighborhood, you can't take away the parking spaces without simultaneous increases in funding for public transit routes, and that's not happening.
That's not happening, yeah. And I've talked about this before, that we need more funding for transit, and we need better transit.
All right, let's move on. Speaking of transit, there was an arena traffic study that came out this week.
Yeah, this week the city released their sort of cursory traffic study for the arena, for the proposed third arena in the Soto neighborhood.
That was the official title, wasn't it? Cursory traffic study?
The cursory traffic study.
Emphasis on curse.
This is the study that was paid for by Chris Hansen, the hedge fund manager who has proposed putting up some private funding to build the arena. And of course, not surprisingly, the study said that there would be no impact on Soto traffic by building the third arena. But it really, there were a lot of things it didn't look at. For example, it didn't look at the impact on freight traffic in an area of the city that's heavily dependent on traffic between the port and the rest of the city.
Yeah, in fact, almost all the other traffic down there is freight traffic.
Yeah, it also didn't take into account that traffic problems on game days start in the early afternoon, not after 4:30 p.m. when the port closes, which is what the study assumed. It also assumed that for an 18,000-seat arena, that only 6,000 people, on a sold-out game, that only 6,000 people would drive. It also said that about 81% would drive, which means they would each be carrying at least one or two passengers, which I have to tell you is a false assumption. It also assumed that 9% of attendees would get there by bus or train, and that 10% would get there in some other way, unspecified some other way.
Flapping their arms and flying.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, they're not going to get there by walking. It's too far to walk from a job downtown down there. Some very young people and very athletic people might do it, but certainly not 10%. And then it also assumed, too, that there would be lots of parking available if, and this is the major assumption, if people want to walk up to 3/4 of a mile from their car to the arena, which I have to tell you, nope, that's not what people will want to do.
All right. Moving on, the Department of Justice.
Yeah, the Department of Justice this week sent two letters to City Attorney Pete Holmes about SPD or reforms at the Seattle Police Department. The first letter was described as in scathing language, calling the city's response inadequate. This is the response that the city made to the Department of Justice proposed changes on Wednesday of last week.
I think the word preposterous appeared a couple times too.
Yeah, it may have. And then the second letter was much shorter than the first letter, but it basically said that the city had to get serious about negotiating reforms at the Seattle Police Department. And meanwhile, in the last 2 weeks, the SPD has twice encountered hostile crowds at crime scenes. First at a shooting in Rainier Beach, where the victim died while waiting for the Seattle police to make a corridor so that paramedics could get through the crowd to get to him. And the second time this Thursday at a stabbing on Capitol Hill. And it really points out that the city has got to get serious about negotiating and making a real effort to sit down with the Department of Justice to come to some real reforms at the SPD, because in the meantime, it's creating a real hostile situation with the community.
And it really underscores that the city does not understand the nature of the problem that it has with SPD. The city is treating this like it's a public relations problem. It is not a public relations problem. It is a problem of many, many different communities within the larger fabric of the city of Seattle not trusting the Seattle Police Department, period. And the Seattle Police Department and the city have to take proactive steps to regain that trust, over a period of time, and none of that is accounted for in what the city has proposed so far.
Yeah, the mayor really has to stop treating this as if it's a lawsuit he has to fight, as if the DOJ has already filed a lawsuit that he has to sit down and protect the city from. He needs to treat it as a real negotiation, and that's not what's happening.
And again, the problem here is not the Department of Justice. The problem is the lack of trust for city residents for the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah.
That's the underlying problem, whether the DOJ files a lawsuit or not.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, charter schools.
Yeah, this week another charter school initiative was filed. This is the fourth time that an initiative, if it makes the November ballot, will be the fourth time that Washington State residents will be voting on a charter school initiative. Now, the initiatives for charter schools were voted down in 1996, in 2000, and again in 2004. It seems that this charter school initiative has a lot of money behind it, because they're expecting to be able to get 250,000 signatures in about a month's time for it to qualify in the November ballot. So you have to be asking yourself, okay, who's behind this and why? Now, currently, I also want to point out too that that in this initiative, it would allow about 40 charter schools to be set up. But of course, the money to run those would come right out of the public school budget that the state uses to pay for public schools.
You know, those public schools that the state is already in are a court order to improve the outcomes for, because they don't fund it adequately.
Yeah, to try to fund them adequately, because right now the state of Washington doesn't fund public schools enough, and pulling money out of the pot in order to pay for private schools for a few students just does not seem like a good allocation of resources.
Now, as Maria mentioned there, we don't know yet what the funding is for this particular initiative drive, but we do know what the previous initiative efforts in 96 and 2000 and 2004 have been. They primarily have come from a handful of wealthy companies and individuals who have interest in the for-profit charter school movement. Paul Allen being one of the, I don't know if he still is, but was in those
in the
earlier
past
initiatives,
was, yeah.
He was heavily involved in those. So there's a lot of heavy hitters who are potentially involved in this. And the way our initiative process now works, that's all you need to get it on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Amazon had a big meeting this week.
Yeah, this week the Amazon.com had their board meeting at the Seattle Public Library here in Seattle, and a couple hundred protesters came down to stand outside the Seattle Public Library, hold signs, and make some demands of Amazon. Their main demands, which weren't covered in the media much here, was that they wanted Amazon to pay their fair share of taxes. Amazon is known for not wanting to pay federal taxes, but most particularly state and local taxes, and things like the sales tax in particular. They also were demanding that Amazon improve working conditions at its warehouses. Apparently, a warehouse that they have in Pennsylvania is particularly bad. In the summertime, it can get up to 100 degrees or more inside the warehouse.
Yeah, there's a newspaper in Allentown, Pennsylvania that did a searing expose of conditions in an Amazon warehouse a couple of years ago. And that still applies.
Yeah, and they also demanded that Amazon treat their workers better, and that they stop giving money to a right-wing group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC for short. ALEC's list of crimes include promoting the Stand Your Ground legislation, which played a key role in the Florida Trayvon Martin case. The Stand Your Ground legislation allows people to shoot someone if they feel they are being threatened by them, regardless of where they are, whether they're in their own home or out on the city street. ALEC also has tried to repeal environmental and safety standards. They support restrictive voter ID laws that tend to disenfranchise the poor, disabled, and elderly. They also helped draft and pass Arizona's odious immigration law. And active members of ALEC include companies like ExxonMobil and Koch Industries.
Yeah, and what ALEC is, it's a compendium of companies and right-wing state legislators that are used to introduce these sort of templates of right-wing legislation in state legislatures all over the country. So this is why you're seeing identical war on women type legislation, voter ID legislation,
and they wine and
like
dine. They wine and dine conservative
and a lot of money changes hands.
Yeah, and so
that's
Amazon. Yeah, and Amazon was part of that coalition. Fortunately, this week, in response to protests both outside and inside their meeting, their shareholders meeting, Amazon agreed to withdraw from ALEC. They also are saying, at least, that they will improve conditions at the warehouse in Allentown, Pennsylvania. They didn't make a blanket promise to improve conditions in all their warehouses. However, it would be very nice if we could hear them say that.
And even better, do it.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, a bag ban in L.A.?
Yeah, Los Angeles this week became the 48th city in the United States to ban plastic grocery bags and the largest city yet. It passed the L.A. City Council by a 13-1 vote, and they also approved a 10-cent fee for paper bags. They have now joined San Francisco, San Jose, Long Beach, and, of course, our very own Seattle as a city that has cleaned up their act in regards to plastic grocery bags. And I just want to give everybody out there a little reminder that the Seattle plastic bag ban starts on July 1st, so you better go out and get your cloth bags while you can.
All right. Moving on to national and Adam Smith.
Yeah, Adam Smith, the Democratic Congress creature from suburban Tacoma, Seattle, was in the national news this week per offering in the House of Representatives a couple of amendments to the notorious National Defense Authorization Act. Rejected this week in the House was a ban on indefinite detention of suspected terrorists caught on U.S. soil. That would have been a good amendment. However, the bad amendment got a little more traction. That was Smith's effort to repeal prohibition of domestic government propaganda. Well, you may say, what's wrong with that? Because, the government has been trying to find ways around that for decades already. But at least technically, it is actually illegal or was illegal for the United States government to propagandize its own citizens.
In other words, it was illegal for the government to lie to you.
Yes. It's not illegal to do that anymore. Oddly enough. Thank you, Adam Smith, for that. He's our local legislator, and exactly why Mr. Smith thinks that is a good idea is anybody's guess.
All right. Related to that, a federal district court ruling?
Yeah, Second Circuit U.S. District Judge Catherine Forrest last week, in a 68-page scathing opinion, ruled that a section of the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, was unconstitutional. This is a lawsuit that was spearheaded by the journalist and columnist Christopher Hedges. Noam Chomsky and a number of other prominent leftist political commentators were also part of it, and they were arguing that because of the reporting or opinions that they've done, literally the NDAA was so broadly worded that they felt that they themselves were personally liable under the NDAA for indefinite detention because they've written about and in some cases had interviewed people who were associated with groups that the U.S. government claims are terrorist groups. District Judge Catherine Forrest ruled that it was unconstitutional because the government cannot strip U.S. citizens of due process or use the military to arrest those people and hold them in military prisons indefinitely, and also struck down language while she was at it that allowed the government to jail people based on what somebody says or writes. That's a huge victory, and it's going to be appealed now, of course, to a higher court by the Obama administration, the most transparent administration ever. But and if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, chances are fairly good this will be overturned because of the nature of the Supreme Court right now. But at least for the time being, at least somebody in the federal court system has taken the highly unusual step of challenging the U.S. security state. And for that, Hedges and Chomsky and the other plaintiffs deserve an enormous amount of credit. Underscoring where the Obama administration sits on on national security issues. It was also revealed this week that the administration is pushing for full renewal without amendments of the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. Now, if you go into the Wayback Machine and remember that in the last year of the Bush administration, this was an insanely controversial thing that was before Congress that basically retroactively immunized the telecommunications companies and legalized all the warrantless spying that was being done by the Bush administration. And Barack Obama, as a candidate for president in that year, had said he would vote against that authorization and then turned around and flipped and voted for it, which was something of a furor at the time. But the consolation was that Congress put a four-year sunset provision on it. Well, it's now 4 years later. The law is about to run out, and you have both the Democratic president and the Republican so-called opposition saying we should just renew this thing as it is, and it's not even considered controversial at this point. And that really underscored the danger of what happened during the Bush administration and what happens anytime you have erosions of civil rights like this, is that it's controversial when the first person does it, and then when the second person from the opposing party comes in and does the same thing, it's suddenly no longer controversial. It becomes established precedent, and you never get those rights back. And that's exactly what's happened here.
All right. The SEC.
Yeah, this week the SEC announced that they were going to investigate the Facebook IPO. When the Facebook IPO debuted last week, their shares lost approximately one quarter of their value within a day. Apparently, some of the banks that were involved in the IPO, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and some other banks, knew that Facebook's quarterly earnings would be less than they projected. Facebook gave them a little advisory about that. But evidently,
Isn't that called insider trading?
Well, that's why the SEC's looking at it. Apparently, individual investors didn't get the same briefing from Facebook. And so that could be a bit of a serious violation of SEC rules if Facebook hadn't already disclosed that in its SEC reporting, but then just told a few banks and hedge funds and other wealthy investors. So, you know, it's kind of a little interesting sidelight to the whole hype surrounding the Facebook IPO.
Now, how common or uncommon is that? Because I have the distinct impression that one of the reasons Wall Street is kind of a mug's game is that a lot of the institutional investors a lot of time have much more information than
yes.
a casual investor does.
Yes, and that's one of the major problems with investing these days. A lot of people, particularly a lot of individual investors, are complaining to the SEC that really they're not playing on the same field. It's not only not a level playing field, they're just not even on the same field as some of these big hedge funds and some of these wealthier investors.
Health insurance.
Yeah, this week an online magazine called Health Affairs published an article saying that more than 50% of the individual insurance plans that Americans hold don't meet the minimum standards of the Health Care Reform Act. And some of the ways in which they don't meet it include their deductibles and copays are way too high. Some families pay up to $27,000 or more out of pocket each year, even though they're supposedly covered by an individual insurance plan. Often these insurance plans don't provide enough coverage. They don't include coverage for things like maternity care, for example. And often these plans exclude pre-existing conditions. In fact, you could argue that most times individual plans offered by insurance companies don't include pre-existing conditions, which would have to be covered under the Health Care Reform Act. Now, what the study found, too, was that people who are covered through their employer-provided plans often have insurance that meets the standards. And there's a reason for that. It's because if you're a company that provides health insurance, many companies don't, but if you do provide health insurance, it's usually because other companies within your industry do. And if you want to attract and keep good employees, you have to provide enough coverage in order to do that. And that's kind of one of the reasons why a lot of people like their employer-provided health insurance plan. But I think it's an argument for a government-provided plan so that you don't have these inequities.
All right. The NATO summit last week.
Yes, last week we saw big protests at the NATO summit. Did you want to talk a little bit about that, John?
Really? I didn't see anything about that in the media.
Well, it even leaked into the Seattle Times, I think.
I'm sure it did on page B14 under Around the Country. as has become kind of standard for a lot of these large international summits held in cities in the United States, and we know all about that. Chicago has turned into something of a police state over last weekend. Very large protests in Chicago. Also, the full standard slate of treatment that you see for these protests and protesters, preemptive unconstitutional arrests, penning, media hysteria, and a dramatic underreporting of the protests themselves. In this case, it's particularly instructive because most of the focus of the protests was on the war in Afghanistan, which of course was one of the main focuses of the different ministers and people who attended the NATO summit. And if you look at the public opinion polls, somewhere, depending on the poll, between 60% and 70% of people in the United States want the United States to end its engagement in Afghanistan sooner rather than later. So it's a sweeping majority opinion in the United States, again, if you believe the opinion polls, and yet protesters who are agitating for this against their elected officials can't get anything even remotely approaching respectful treatment for media coverage here. Why would that be?
Yeah, and it's interesting, what came out of the NATO summit was basically an announcement by NATO allies that they were going to be leaving or ending the NATO mission in the summer of 2013. Of course, that's not true for the United States military. U.S. military spokesman, even as recently as this week, said that the U.S. is going to continue fighting there through 2014 and after, because the new agreement with the Afghan government spells out U.S. troop presence for after 2014 and probably indefinitely to act as quote-unquote advisors to the Afghan military, which
through,
we will
through
be,
2024 was the actual
which we
act.
Will be yeah which we will be funding more than $4 billion a year to try to get the Afghan military up to snuff.
And that is a document that was not debated publicly and does not have to be passed through Congress through some obscure hocus pocus. That doesn't really make any constitutional sense.
I thought treaties were supposed to be approved by Congress, but apparently not.
Silly you.
All right. It leaves us just about a minute to talk about the Egyptian elections.
Yeah, Egyptian elections. Two people in the runoff for the presidency in the first democratic elections in Egypt in a very, very long time, probably several thousand years. Ahmed Shafik, who was the last prime minister from Hosni Mubarak, and Mohamed Morsi, who is the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, each of them getting about 25% of the vote. The third candidate, the so-called leftist Hamdi Sabahi, who is the favored candidate of the pro-democracy forces, got about 21%. And if you open up your Seattle Times this morning and look at the AP article there, it really is one of the best primers you could ever want to see on biased reporting in the U.S. media of foreign events, even though it is factually correct. A 31-paragraph story in which nothing positive whatsoever is ever said about the Muslim Brotherhood, which, of course, is the party that won the majority of, or a plurality, that is, of the votes in Egypt's first election, and one that, if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't actually realize that they have been opposed to the dictatorship in Egypt for decades. In fact,
and that they have actually become much more mainstream than they've been in the past.
Yeah. Instead, all you saw was the dread word Islamist without any actual description of, oh, say, what their policies might be. It really is a dreadful example of the ignorance of U.S. foreign policy reporting. And I would urge folks to check that out and then check out just about any international reporting to see what the difference is.
Events.
A couple of them that we should mention. Folklife, of course, going on all this week, and today's supposed to be the warm sunny day, so go out there and join the quarter bazillion people who will be at Seattle Center.
And go by bus, please.
Yes.
And or then, bike or walk.
Or flap your arms and fly. I hear the Seattle City of Seattle is recommending that.
Use your transporter.
Yeah, that would work. And then Thursday night, May 31st, from 7 to 8:30 p.m., Tim Harris of Real Change, always a very good and very compelling writer and speaker, is going to be talking at the Common Good Cafe at the University Temple United Methodist Church, talking about systemic homelessness as the logical conclusion of the corporate economy. And he would have some very choice things to say about that, I'm I'm sure.
That's a great series, too, by the way.
Yeah, it is. They're doing a 7-week series. This is another week in them, and they're going through, I believe, the end of June. So check that out. United Temple, University Temple, United Methodist at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find more of my work at mariatomchik.com.